Our obsession with anti-aging creams and plastic surgery might make you think that our lust for immortality is pretty new. But it goes back a long way to ancient Egypt and early China. In fact, author Stephen Cave thinks our efforts to cheat death by living forever are the driving force behind civilization. Cave spells out his argument in his book, Immortality. Steve Paulson talks with him.
Stephen, the subtitle of your book is The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization, which is quite a provocative statement. Do you really think our obsession with immortality has shaped civilization?
Yes, I do. And all living things want to keep going, to project themselves into the future. And we humans are no different. And in fact, because we have these massive brains, we can conceive of the future extending indefinitely before us. So whereas other creatures just want to survive moment by moment, we want to live forever. And civilization is how we try to do that.
You'll have to explain that. How do we do that through civilization?
Well, think, for example, of all the material aspects of civilization. So we build buildings to give us shelter, and we have clothing to keep us warm. Agriculture puts food on the table. Medicine prevents us from falling to disease. So all of these material aspects of civilization, they really exist just to help us live longer. But of course, even though they really do help us to live longer, still death looms over us. And so we have these other aspects of civilization, these more symbolic, cultural, religious aspects like art and Christianity, that promise that even if the buildings and the agriculture and the medicine don't do it for us, still we can live on.
You approach this subject in many different fascinating ways. For instance, you talk about something you call the mortality paradox. Can you explain what this is?
The mortality paradox, it starts with the realization that at some point, some early human's brain got big enough for them to realize, oh my God, we're going to die. Presumably mice and snakes, they don't know this. They live from moment to moment. But because we can conceive of ourselves in the future, we can have this realization. All living things die. I'm a living thing. I'm going to die. And this is, of course, terrifying. And this forms one side of the mortality paradox. But on the other hand, we can't really imagine not existing. We can't conceive of dying, of being dead. It's a kind of logical impossibility. So this is the paradox. On the one hand, death seems to us inevitable and inescapable. On the other hand, it seems inconceivable and impossible. And this is a contradiction. But we don't live with this contradiction. We don't live with this paradox. We tell ourselves stories that help to resolve it.
Which suggests that it would scare a lot of people. I mean, you know, basically we know we're going to die. We can't do anything about it. We're incapable of, in some deep way, of dealing with the terror of death. But there are strategies. And you, for instance, talk about something called the terror management theory. What is that?
That's right. The terror management theory is this body of research in psychology that says, look, the basic fact that we're going to die is terrifying to us. We're not built to have to deal with this fact. And so we tell ourselves stories. We shape our worldview in ways that help us to manage the terror of death. That's why it's called terror management theory. Now, various thinkers and philosophers and people like Freud have thought this in the past, going back thousands of years. But the people, the researchers behind terror management theory, a group of American psychologists, set out to actually prove this in the lab. So, for example, they'd take a group of people. One recent study took a group of agnostics, that is, people who are kind of undecided in their religious views, and they reminded half of them they were going to die, and the other half they made to think about dental pain or something equally horrible, but not death. And then they asked them again about their religious views. Now, those who had been reminded of their mortality were afterwards twice as likely to express faith in God, even though beforehand they were all equally agnostic. So remind people of death, get them to think about mortality, and they run to Jesus. So this is evidence that our religions, for example, are strategies we have to help us deal with the fear of death. And this applies not just to religion, but the terror management theory researchers have now, in over 400 studies, shown this applies also to nationalism. So the idea that you can live on as part of your nation, or the desire for fame, for example, or even the desire to have children.
Well, let's talk about this in more detail, because you have argued that there are four basic ways that every civilization chases after immortality. Basically, we have four immortality narratives. The first one you call staying alive. What is that?
Well, that's right. I think there appears at first to be a huge diversity of different kinds of story about how we can defeat death. But actually, they all fit into four basic categories. And the first of these, the first immortality story, is, as you say, staying alive, because it's the most obvious. If you don't want to die, well, just keep going, just stay alive. So it's the idea that we can do that in this body, on this earth, forever. And we mentioned before that civilization is helping us to do this. I mean, life expectancy has doubled in the last couple hundred years, from just 40 to 80 in the Western world. So we're really making this happen. We really are living longer. And yet still the idea that we can stay alive forever just seems a little bit eccentric. And yet every culture in human history has some story of an elixir of life or fountain of youth or something that can help to keep us going forever.
Right. Well, then there's another solution to this, which is your third immortality narrative, and that's the soul. Okay, maybe we don't have to worry about the body living on forever, but the soul perhaps could once the body dies.
That's right. The idea of the soul neatly solves this problem for us. And we see this in the history of Christianity. Early Christians put their faith in the resurrection. They thought they'd die, and then they're properly actually dead until the moment of resurrection. But we have this problem about putting people back together. And so some Christians thought, well, hang on, if we've got a soul as well, then the soul can bridge this gap. So we're not really dead, because this fundamental part of us, the soul, is living on. And this is a hugely attractive idea, because then suddenly we're not dependent upon this messy, unreliable body, but we each have a part of us, if you like, the real me, the real you, that is by its nature immortal, that can leave the body behind. And so death, then, instead of becoming a source of anxiety, becomes liberation. It's the moment when the soul is free. And if you have that view, it's much easier to deal with the fear of mortality.
Of course, there are all kinds of philosophical problems with the soul. I mean, are we talking about our consciousness living on precisely as it was when we had a body and a brain and all of that? Does the sense of self stay together?
Well, in the West, when most people think of a soul, they think of their full personality, their consciousness and their memories and their desires and their beliefs. But the problem is, science suggests that all of those things, consciousness and memories, are dependent upon the brain. And of course, if I knock you on the head in a certain way, if a bit of your brain is destroyed, then your memories can disappear. Or other fundamental parts of you can disappear if your brain is damaged, your capacity for love or your idea of right and wrong. And the question is, well, if these things are actually dependent upon a soul, how is it that they get knocked out when a bit of the brain's damaged? And if your memories or your capacity for right and wrong can't survive just a bit of your brain being damaged, what makes us think it can survive when your whole brain dies, like when you die? And so increasingly, people are becoming skeptical of the idea that the real me or the real you can actually just leave the body behind.
Now, we've been talking with the assumption that everyone wants immortality in one way or another, but that is not absolutely obvious. That would be such a great thing. And there are people who have questioned that. For instance, the great Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges wrote a story called The Immortal. Can you describe what happens in that story?
Yes, Borges tells this wonderful story about a soldier in ancient Rome who he's seeking the river that cleanses men of death. And he goes on this great epic quest. And eventually he comes to this sort of desert. And there are these troglodyte-like people just lying around. One of them hasn't moved for so long that a bird has nested on his chest. And he finds out eventually these are the immortals. And he finds out one of them is Homer, who wrote the Odyssey and the Iliad. And this Roman soldier says, well, what a glorious thing. Aren't you proud? And Homer says, no, don't you see? If you live forever, it is impossible not to write the Odyssey at least once. And so the idea is, if we live forever, we'll all end up doing everything. And so we all become the same person, and we all become both villain and victim and king and pauper. And after a while, all meaning breaks down, all purpose breaks down.
I mean, that is a profound idea, that somehow we need mortality to have meaning in our lives.
That's right. It's mortality that gives shape to our lives and forces us to make choices, and it's those choices that define us. If we have infinite time, we can all do everything. And so all our actions lose their meaning.
Okay. Well, you have looked at all these immortality narratives that have been floating around for eons. You suggest that maybe there's another one, that we could have a better one, what you call the wisdom narrative. Explain what that is.
So I found, looking at all these immortality stories in different cultures, different times, there have always been these quiet voices that say, well, hang on, I'm not sure I'm convinced about this. immortality story. And we find these voices even in ancient Egypt, which dedicated its entire economy to the pyramids and the tombs and to mummification. Every now and again, we find a little bit of graffiti on a pyramid saying, now, hang on, all of these mummies, has anyone ever seen them come back? You know, make merry while you can. And this message we see in this recurring literature called the wisdom literature from the Near East. And that's why I call this story the wisdom narrative. I've taken that from these, from this wisdom literature, which we find, for example, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the oldest stories that we have, and in the wisdom books of the Bible, like the Psalms and Ecclesiastes, for example. And the message is always, well, look, we don't really know about this living forever business, and maybe it's not such a good idea. So let's focus on the here and now instead. Let's appreciate what we have. And that's very much the message of Ecclesiastes. And Psalm number 90 goes even further and says, learn to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. So actually learn to think about the fact that our time is limited. We have to face up to mortality in order to gain wisdom, which means in order to really appreciate the time that we have.
Stephen Cave is the author of Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever, and How It Drives Civilization. He spoke with Steve Paulson. If you could choose an alternative ending for your life, what would it be? You can share your thoughts with us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always great to hear from you.